It's Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey on 1330 WHBL.
Good morning and welcome to Legal Defense. I'm Casey Hoff, flying solo this morning. A lot to talk about, including Jameis Winston, the Florida State quarterback, and actually a candidate for the Heisman Trophy this year. Florida State quarterback Jameis Winston is under a cloud of suspicion, as we still don't know if he's going to be charged with any kind of crime related to sexual assault allegations. This case actually goes back to December of 2012, when there was an investigation that apparently began after a woman came forward and reported that she had been raped by this quarterback, Jameis Winston. Now, whether that's true or not is a whole other question that we don't really know about. But although it was reported back then, we really didn't have a reopening of this investigation or anything all that serious occurring in terms of the investigation until relatively recently. The woman says that she came back from a bar. She had an alcohol shot at the bar before leaving in a cab, and then she was raped. Jameis Winston maintains his innocence, and his defense lawyers have said that they have two affidavits from witnesses that they say would provide exculpatory evidence. In other words, evidence that would go towards Jameis Winston's innocence. Although we don't know what those affidavits say, because we don't even know if Jameis Winston is going to be charged with anything. Now, he's been playing for the past several weeks under this cloud of suspicion, and in terms of this case, he hasn't been charged yet, and that's a very difficult position for a person to be in. I mean, imagine being in a circumstance where you've got somebody accusing you of a very serious crime, and yet the prosecution has not charged him yet. Now, I'm not saying that the prosecution is at fault necessarily for that. They absolutely need to look into the details of this case before deciding whether to charge. And I think it's always prudent for a prosecutor, and in fact, I think it's a responsibility of a prosecutor, to very carefully decide whether or not he or she is going to charge another person with a crime. Because being charged with a crime, especially a sexual-related crime, can literally ruin the rest of a person's life, even if he's innocent and completely innocent of it. Now, the prosecutor has said, hasn't indicated necessarily when formal charges are going to come, if they're going to come at all, but has apparently interviewed the alleged victim in this case. Another facet of this Jameis Winston case is the notion that perhaps Jameis Winston, because he is a very good quarterback for a very popular football team and a very good football team, Florida State University, that maybe he's getting preferential treatment. And there have been suggestions that when the alleged victim came forward initially, she was told by the police something to the effect of, well, you really don't want to bring these allegations forward because this could come back to haunt you, and he's a big football star, and you don't want to take away our football star. It's in Tallahassee, Florida. So there's been criticism of the police department there in Tallahassee. There's been criticism as to how this investigation has handled, and there's also been questions as to the timing of it. In other words, why did it take this long to even act on something, and they really haven't acted on anything yet? But something that really caught my eye when talking about this Jameis Winston story and reading about it and about these allegations of sexual assault by this quarterback are that it's disturbing to me that some in the press are talking about how the prosecutor in this case can't win either way, because if he chooses to charge Jameis Winston with a crime, then you're going to have all the Florida State fans upset because he's not going to be in contention likely for the Heisman Trophy. They probably won't go to the national championship game and all of those things. On the other hand, if you don't charge him, then you're going to have other groups of people upset because they think that the quarterback is getting preferential treatment. When really, I think we're losing sight of the big picture in this, and that is that the prosecutor has a responsibility to make the appropriate decision and to not be swayed by any of these groups coming forward. It's a difficult thing about being a prosecutor. I mean, you have a great responsibility in your hands when you're deciding to charge someone or not charge someone with a crime. And so great care and caution ought to be taken in any of these circumstances. But as to whether this is political, it just shouldn't be. And I know that across the country, in many parts of the country, prosecutors are elected to office by the people. So in some ways, you can say, well, that's political in and of itself. But in most areas of the country, at least that I've heard, there's supposed to be nonpartisan races. And even if there are political races, once you get into office with the enormous amount of responsibility that somebody in that position has, it ought not be taken lightly. And so is Jameis Winston being treated like a coddled quarterback at a university, or is he getting the raw end of this deal because the woman who's accusing him has some other ulterior motive in mind for doing so? And perhaps we'll never get to the bottom of that story, but I hope that we do. And I'm confident that we will, in the very near future, at least get an answer. Because that's something that you can't imagine. I mean, I can't imagine if somebody were to accuse another person of a serious crime like this. I don't know how he plays football. I don't know how he goes in and out every year or every week after week, and plays these, you know, high-intensity, high-profile football games and plays at a very high level when you have this cloud of suspicion over your head. So part of me says, well, this is really unfortunate, because the fact that this got leaked to the media, and now we're talking about it, everybody's talking about it, is unfortunate for Jameis Winston, because he hasn't been charged with anything. And unfortunately, in this country, there are a lot of people who believe that even if you are accused of something, even if you're not formally charged, then you must have done something wrong. And of course, that's not the way that our system of justice works. We have a presumption of innocence. And we have that for good reason, because before you're going to put someone away and before you're going to take away someone's freedom, in this country, we value that presumption of innocence, and we want the government to make to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that you have committed some kind of offense. Now, in this situation, he hasn't even yet been charged. And so in terms of any protections for him, well, he really has none, because his lawyers are rightly telling him, hey, Jameis Winston, don't say anything about this because you don't want it to be misinterpreted in some way and come back to bite you, even if you've done absolutely nothing wrong. Because as we've talked about many times in the show before, the pauses in which somebody answers questions, the way, the demeanor in which somebody answers questions can be used against that person in very, very damaging ways. Even if they're completely innocent, they've done absolutely nothing wrong, and they have, quote unquote, nothing to hide. So we'll see as we follow this story. We'll, of course, follow it closely and bring you updates on Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey. Another story that's making the rounds involves a Stevens Point area high school student who posted a YouTube video apparently performing a rap song with crude and vulgar sexual language about his Spanish teacher. And that made the rounds on the internet, although his lawyer says it was never directed at the Spanish teacher herself, but rather was a video that was posted online for YouTube. Now, it's still obviously not a good thing that was done, but the question becomes whether that was free speech. And a court ruled this week in Wisconsin that, in fact, the video, and the trial judge, I think, said something like it was one of the most vulgar videos, I'm paraphrasing here, but one of the most vulgar videos he's ever seen. Well, the Court of Appeals said, hey, you know what? It may be vulgar, it may be bad, but it is protected freedom of speech. And so there was kind of a split ruling that I won't get into detail on this program, but suffice it to say that this boy, and I'm assuming it's a boy, although we don't know because juvenile proceedings are in secret, and the name of the actual person has not been released. But we know that the boy or the girl is 15 years old and performed this rap song with crude and vulgar language. He was actually found delinquent in juvenile court of disorderly conduct and unlawfully using a computerized communications system. But again, then we have this ruling this week about how it was protected speech. And I really think this is something that we're going to see a lot of in the near future and probably right now, because we have so much of this internet culture and we have so many people on the internet who are posting and saying things that they may regret later in life, but they are there forever. Once you post them, really, it's very difficult to get them to come down, and they don't come down. And, you know, a lot of people, even though the court ruled the way that it did in this case, a lot of parents out there are saying, and I think for good reason, you know what? This internet thing is great and there's a lot of benefits to it, but I think that when it comes to other things about the internet, you know, the freedom of expression is a wonderful thing, and I'm a huge proponent of freedom of expression. Not in this way, obviously. I mean, it's not that I'd say it's not protected, because it is protected, but it doesn't mean it's a good thing to perform a crude rap song. It really isn't. But the bottom line is, in order to protect popular speech, we have to protect unpopular speech. And in this circumstance, this student did this. But there are a whole bunch of collateral consequences for people on the internet. And they seem to think that they live in the here and now. And whatever they post on the internet, it really doesn't matter because they're doing it in the moment, when in fact they don't think about the long-term consequences of doing something like that. Getting a job, you know, just being there, because people Google other people all the time now and they find out things about them that they would never have known even as little as 20 years ago. So this just serves as another example of that. This is Legal Defense. I'm Casey Hoff. We'll be back in just a moment.
Now back to Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey on 1330 WHBL.
Welcome back to Legal Defense. I'm Casey Hoff. Another big story in the news this week related to criminal matters is the trial of Michael Skakel, who is a cousin of Robert F. Kennedy Jr. And I know we talked about JFK last week on the 50th anniversary of his assassination, but this is a totally different story involving a Kennedy family cousin, Michael Skakel, who in 1975... there was actually a murder of a 15-year-old girl named Martha Moxley. Now, Michael Skakel at the time was also a young man, and he was ultimately accused of committing this murder. Now, the facts of the murder are really as follows. Moxley was simply found beneath a tree in her family's backyard with a broken golf club by her side. And so there were questions as to how that happened. But Skakel was ultimately accused of this, and he admitted to climbing into a tree and performing a sexual act while looking into Moxley's bedroom. Now, he ended up not being convicted until 2002 and was sentenced to 20 years to life in prison. And he actually spent the last 10 years in prison and has maintained his innocence all along. One of the things that he did was he basically said that his lawyer didn't do an inadequate job, and so he alleged what's called ineffective assistance of counsel. Under the Sixth Amendment to the United States Constitution, a person has the right to counsel, and there's a very famous case on this called Strickland versus Washington that basically sets out the standard as to what counsel is supposed to do in terms of representing somebody, and a person has to prove that their lawyer was not only deficient, but also that there was a resulting prejudice. And there's been a lot of case law on this, and there have been cases that have even found that a lawyer was not deficient, even when that lawyer fell asleep during portions of his client's trial, which to me, you know, sounds pretty unbelievable. And it's kind of a high standard that way. But the judge actually found in this case that the lawyer was ineffective. And so Michael Skakel, in other words, Michael Skakel didn't receive a fair trial. Now, what the judge cited various reasons for this, and basically they boiled down to the lawyer failing to show attention to detail, lacking any coherent strategy, failing to argue that someone else committed the murder, and in this case, that someone else could have been Thomas Skakel, who is Michael Skakel's brother, and also failed to interview a critical alibi witness, in addition to failing to undermine the state's witness. So what happened then was Michael Skakel, after his conviction was overturned, was immediately, there was a hearing for his release. His lawyers argued for bail in terms of him being able to, the judge setting a cash bail and Michael Skakel being able to post it. And ultimately, the judge set Michael Skakel's bail at $1.2 million, which he comes from a very wealthy family and was able to post. In addition, he has to have essentially an electronic monitoring ankle bracelet on, and he can't leave the state without permission from the judge. So his conviction was overturned. So right now, he's sort of in limbo. Prosecutors have said that they plan on appealing the judge's decision, finding that Michael's original lawyer was ineffective. And so, pending that appeal, we'll see where this case goes. Now, ultimately, they could attempt to retry Michael Skakel because he didn't receive a fair trial. But we'll see where that actually goes. And one of the things about this that is really troubling is that, unfortunately, in this country, although we have a wonderful justice system, it certainly is not without its flaws. And one of the flaws, I think, and there's a lot of blame to go around on this, but basically amounts to a lack of funding for a lot of lawyers, especially lawyers who are helping those who are indigent, who are poor. There's been a vast array of research on this and data that suggests that perhaps there are many more people other than Michael Skakel sitting in prison right now for either crimes they didn't commit or they didn't get a fair trial, or whatever reasons there might be. And unfortunately, because they aren't Michael Skakel, because they don't have access to all of that money, they really can't do anything about it. And that's really a tragedy, because we ought to have a justice system that takes care of and protects people's rights when they're accused of crimes. It doesn't matter what the crime is, they ought to be protected because, again, our founders set up some very important principles for this country, including the presumption of innocence, the right to a fair trial, all of those things, the right to counsel. So in this situation, Michael Skakel is released, but it just brings to bear how many other Michael Skakels are there out there and what exactly will happen to those folks who are left behind by the system. We'll continue to follow this case as we continue with Legal Defense. I'm Casey Hoff. There was a very troubling story this week in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel about an ex-Greenfield police officer who was fined for throwing a suspect into a jail cell. It reads in part, a former Greenfield police officer was fined $1,500 on Wednesday in order to perform 200 hours of community service for violently throwing a woman into a jail holding cell in July. This man's name is Thomas Rezac, 30 years old. He was suspended following the incident, and he resigned from the department effective November 1st. He was initially charged with felony misconduct in office, but pleaded no contest Wednesday to misdemeanor battery as part of an agreement with prosecutors. And basically what happened in this case is you had this woman, Amanda Luke of Oak Creek, who had been arrested on charges of driving while revoked and driving with a prohibited blood alcohol concentration and also fleeing an officer. Now, there was a complaint where the woman had been removed from a holding cell for booking. He then ordered her to return to the cell. She then apparently placed her hands on the officer's chest and addressed him with some type of vulgarity. But then the officer really acted inappropriately. He lifted her by the torso, according to this article, carried her across a hallway and flung her into the cell, where she bounced off a steel stool fixed on the floor before landing on the floor. The officer then called her an expletive and closed the door without checking on her condition. But unfortunately, the woman suffered very visible bruises across her body. And there were surveillance cameras that captured audio and video of the incident. Now, I believe it was TMJ that had this video up there, and it's extremely disturbing. I mean, the amount of force, I really can't do it justice on the radio, because the amount of force that this woman was thrown into that jail cell is, you know, it's just unbelievable. It looks like she could easily have broken several ribs. I don't think she did, but she could certainly have easily done that with the amount of force that was used to toss her into this cell like a rag doll, really. And the judge in this case actually characterized this incident and said it was more like the victim was thrown, quote, like a sack of potatoes, end quote. That's according to her attorney, actually, who said that. And so it's unbelievable that this whole situation happened in the way it did, because as we have more and more video, we see a lot more of these things. And it used to be that people thought, well, this isn't going to do anything, and what's going to happen as a result of this? Well, it's incidents like this where video really, really helps. And this woman, although she had allegedly done something wrong that evening, and the officer was probably frustrated with her, I don't know if she was intoxicated or what was going on, and he said apparently that she placed her hand on his chest, and that's definitely a no-no. You never want to do that to a police officer, touch the police officer in any way, and yelling a vulgarity. But let's face it, police officers deal with a lot of stuff in society in terms of things that maybe normal, average folks don't have to deal with. And it's really a part of their jobs. And we hold officers to a high level of responsibility to do their jobs in a very professional way. And I'm not saying it's not difficult. I'm not saying that that it's not something that's a difficult job to do. But in this circumstance, there really was no reason to do this. And I think the biggest thing that made this whole situation even worse than it already was the fact that this is a woman who was already in police custody. She was already in a jail cell. And so when you are in captivity and you've got somebody who's holding you there, you know, obviously against your will, nobody wants to be in jail. And then she's treated in this manner. It's extremely disturbing to see. And there were a whole bunch of warnings when you actually had to look at it. You don't have to look at it, but online they had these stories had warnings on them, warning people that it was graphic. And it wasn't graphic in the sense that it showed nudity or anything like that. It was just graphic in the way that they were treated. And one of the things that I think that is a measure and a mark of basically how we are as a society is how we treat the most vulnerable citizens and how we treat people who are and could be looked at in the most repugnant of manners because they've done something that the rest of society thinks is extremely wrong, and in many cases it is wrong. But how our law enforcement treats those folks says a lot about our community and our standards, and it's extremely important. And in many ways, people are not treated like this, but in some ways they are. And there's been some disturbing stories recently that I've read about where there's a lot of brutality going on. And it's something that we need to make sure doesn't happen, because police officers will tell you this. There are many fine police officers. The best way to get a community to cooperate is to have good community relations between the police department and the rest of the members of the community. This incident, unfortunately, doesn't help things down in Greenfield, Wisconsin. I'm Casey Hoff. You're listening to Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey. I'll be back in just a moment.
It's Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey on 1330 WHBL.
And welcome back to Legal Defense. I'm Casey Hoff, flying solo this morning on Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey. Well, Ryan Braun made another apology this week when speaking to reporters. He was part of a hunger drive, essentially. And of course, it was a good cause, but he really had never publicly addressed, at least since accepting the suspension, what happened in terms of the performance-enhancing drug scandal. And Ryan Braun actually met with reporters, and reporters asked him all kinds of questions. But one of the things that was key in this whole thing was that Ryan Braun refused to answer as to specifics in terms of what happened. He said repeatedly that he wanted to move forward and that he wanted to get this whole thing behind him. He never made any mention that he cheated or said anything of the sort. He said that he had actually made amends with the collector the person who he accused, who Ryan Braun accused of mishandling his urine sample. And so he actually said that he had had dinner with him, with this Lorenzi and his family, and had made amends with him. And he also did say that he was deeply remorseful. But these were his first public comments since accepting the suspension. And as we know, in October of 2011, he actually tested positive for elevated testosterone levels, but that test was overturned because of how the sample was handled. And Ryan Braun was very much critical of how the sample was in fact handled. And even I actually also believe that at the time that he did have a point, because it did seem that the procedures were not correct in terms of how everything was handled. But then later we find out more information. Ryan Braun's fiance is standing behind him, both figuratively and literally on camera, and sort of acting as somebody who's very supportive of him, which is fine. And that's something that a lot of spouses do for their husbands or wives when they're involved in some kind of scandal. But I think now that this is done, he has, of course, every right to speak about this incident. And I think that he should, because I think that he does owe Brewer fans an explanation. I mean, there were a lot of people who spent a lot of money on season tickets. Ryan Braun has been a huge investment for the Milwaukee Brewers. And it's something that affects a lot of people. Now, you might view that as, you know, something that's silly because it's just sports. But it is something that people take very, very seriously. And when somebody's integrity is on the line, I think they have to do more than say, well, I'm not going to answer any questions or go into any specifics about how long I've been using performance-enhancing drugs. I mean, he really was saying things like that. He wouldn't answer any of this. So I think until he does that, there is going to be this sort of negative attitude towards Ryan Braun. Now, a lot of fans will forget it and forgive him. And, you know, we all love baseball and many of us love the Milwaukee Brewers. But I'm not sure that in terms of publicly that this whole thing was handled entirely appropriately. And I think rather than saying, well, I'm not going to go into any specifics, it's already done with. I can understand while there's an investigation ongoing and before there's been a decision made as to what's going to happen to Ryan Braun. But that's already happened. I mean, that's over and done with. Ryan Braun also tried to debunk rumors about him being traded to another team, saying that he appreciates Milwaukee. He loves the fans. They've treated him very well. And he intends on staying here for a long, long time. So we'll follow that story. But another thing that I wanted to talk about was Black Friday. Of course, we had Black Friday just yesterday. And that is a major shopping holiday. And I call it a holiday because it really is treated as that. Lots of people go out to different stores, and they even were open on Thanksgiving Day. Many of the stores were this year. Black Friday is something that can bring out the worst in people. And I mean that quite sincerely, because on Black Friday, when people go out to stores, they often behave in very irrational ways. And we like to look on TV, and a lot of us like to think, well, I would never do something like that. I would never be somebody who'd be camping out in front of a Best Buy or stampeding into a Target, you know, to get the latest item, to get that one deal that we really want that'll save us, you know, $50 or something to that effect. But in fact, psychologists have found that the very people who claim never to do that are in fact many of the people who do it. And they behave that way for various different reasons, but there are psychological reasons for doing that. And consumer marketers know this. And so they set up these deals for people to go in. They entice them to bring them in. And it really does bring out an animal-like instinct in people. Psychologists have compared Black Friday shopping in many ways to the hunting and gathering that went on, you know, many, many, many years ago. But it's almost a survivalist thing. And it's not to say that, you know, the person needs that latest iPad or they need that to survive. But people take their wants and they turn them into needs. And really good consumer marketers are able to get people to do that. And it's kind of a sad thing, especially because we have Thanksgiving and many of the stores now are open on Thanksgiving. You have to imagine that years from now, stores will be open the entire day on Thanksgiving. And so people have less time to spend with their families. But the origins of Black Friday actually have something to do with crime itself. So in doing research on this, I found that in the 1950s, Black Friday, and there's various different theories as to how Black Friday, how far it goes back. But in the 1950s, factory managers began to refer to the Friday after Thanksgiving as Black Friday. The reason they did so is because there were so many workers who called in sick on that Friday, the day after Thanksgiving. And one person referred to it as a disease second only to the bubonic plague in its effects on employees. In the 1960s, however, the Philadelphia police started referring to the day after Thanksgiving, the Friday after Thanksgiving, as Black Friday. And in large part, they did that because there were these large shopping crowds. There were all kinds of things that were going on in terms of congesting traffic. And Black Friday really wasn't a positive term. Now it has become a positive term because retailers have turned it into a positive term, referring to retailers being able to move their profits from red to black, really in one single day for many of the retailers. But Black Friday, psychologists have found, really brings out the competitive nature in people because people feel that they need to get that deal. And it's really about a whole bunch of different things, but it's about saving money. It's also about winning a game, because people view shopping, believe it or not, in many respects, as a sport of some type. And retailers are able to create that sense of urgency. Now, when you have the sense of urgency combined with that item that's brought into the store that's deeply discounted, combined with saving money, combined with wanting to be a winner in terms of getting that deal, and also combined with the anxiousness and the nerves of people feeling the need to save money, because let's face it, there are a lot of people who want to make their loved ones happy, and they feel part of the way to do that is by giving gifts. And many people are financially strapped. So when you have all of that, it really can combine into this big ball of combustion that then leads, in some cases, to people actually committing crimes. We've seen people being stampeded at Walmarts and other stores around the country. We've seen people get into fights with each other and throw punches and assaults and all kinds of horrible things that occur on Black Friday. And people watch this on the news and they shake their heads and they say, this could never happen and how could this happen? But it's not to say that the people engaging in that type of behavior are bad people, because most of them probably are not bad people. However, when you have that combination of events that triggers this emotional reaction in the mind, that can have a large effect. And lots of these things are the ways that criminologists study crime and they study human behavior, because we like to think that, oh, it could never be us that gets into trouble. We would never do that because we see how a rational human being reacts to things, and we like to think of ourselves, everybody likes to think of themselves as rational human beings. And part of being a criminal defense lawyer, in my view, is that you come to understand after doing it for long enough that there are lots of people out there who may commit a particular crime, but they're not bad people. I mean, most of the people that are involved in the criminal justice system are not bad people by and large. They may have made a bad decision. They may have made a mistake. They may have done something for various different reasons, and it's not to excuse the behavior. But it is to say that this knee-jerk reaction, to say that anybody involved in anything that even comes close to a Black Friday disaster or any other thing in society for that matter, must be inherently a bad person or evil or whatever the term may be. But it really just is not the case. And psychologists have found that many of the people who we would deem in our everyday lives as normal, who we would be friends with, who we may be friends with and not know about it, have engaged in some type of activity that would embarrass them later on because of this psychological component. And do humans have free will? Of course humans have free will. That's not in question. But do humans always behave rationally in these types of situations? And the answer, I think, clearly is that they do not. This is Legal Defense. I'm Casey Hoff. We'll be back in just a moment.
You're listening to Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey on 1330 WHBL.
And welcome back to Legal Defense. I'm Casey Hoff. There was an 81-year-old man in Wisconsin who got into a lot of trouble this week. This from Channel3000.com. Federal agents said that they've arrested an elderly Wisconsin man after he threatened to shoot President Barack Obama. According to court records, 81-year-old Elwin Nails Fosdale stated during a visit to the Richland Center post office on October 15th that he said, quote, "If President Obama was here, I would shoot him right now or right there and kill him right now," end quote. U.S. Secret Service agents interviewed the man at the Richland Center Police Department the next day. They said that he refused to recant his threat and that he made a number of other threats against President Obama. Fosdale was charged on November 21st with threatening the president, but Fosdale faces other charges in connection with the actions that he's accused of taking with police and family afterward. According to court documents, after Secret Service agents interviewed Fosdale, Richland Center police took him into protective custody for psychological evaluation due to comments that he had made toward the president and also his inconsistencies with speaking to the agents and to the police officers. Police said that Fosdale was combative and resisted and kicked officers while making profane statements. Fosdale was transported to Richland Hospital, where he was medicated to calm him down and evaluated, according to another criminal complaint. He was then taken to the Mendota Mental Health Institute in Madison. The complaint said that Fosdale was released from Mendota November 18th. The next day, Fosdale attacked his daughter at home, and his son-in-law intervened. Fosdale was charged with felony bail jumping, misdemeanor battery with a domestic abuse enhancer, and disorderly conduct with a domestic abuse enhancer in connection with the November 19th incident. He was charged with battery to a peace officer, resisting an officer, and disorderly conduct in connection with the October 16th incident. And officials are saying that Fosdale had recently lost his wife of 57 years and is displacing his grief with anger towards people the Secret Service protects. So this is a very serious situation. Of course, any time that you have a threat to the President of the United States or any other government official, that is a very serious threat, especially the president. That should be taken seriously because, as you know, last week we just had the 50th anniversary of the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. And that was a serious day that where the nation mourned, and the nation still mourns for the death of President John F. Kennedy, because it was such a shock to the country and a shock to the nation. And presidents actually have more protection, really, and they should have more protection than the average citizen does. And the reason is because the president stands for so much more than just him or herself. It's about the presidency of the United States. It's about the very stability of the United States and our country. And so this man, this 81-year-old man, is clearly in a lot of trouble. But something tells me from reading these reports that there may be some mental health issues going on. And in fact, if he was sent to Mendota Mental Health Institute, it seems like there clearly are mental health issues going on. But the fact that somebody grieves the loss of their wife of 57 years is a serious thing that can play into a person's reactions in many ways. And that's certainly not to excuse the events and the statements that this man made in any way, because they're inexcusable, quite frankly, if that's what he truly said. But it is to say that when somebody goes through a large bout of depression, if that's what he went through after losing his wife of 57 years, people can act in a lot of irrational ways. And that may be what happened here. But now that he's allegedly done this, he's in a whole lot of trouble. Speaking of something else that can get folks into trouble, there was a story this past week about a Manitowoc man who was charged in a road rage death. From the Manitowoc newspaper had a piece on this, the Herald Times reporter, that five felony charges were filed this past week in Manitowoc County Circuit Court against a 22-year-old man, Sean Lishka of Manitowoc. He was accused in a road rage death of 19-year-old Eric Newman of Francis Creek. The crash occurred around 10 p.m. on Memorial Drive in Two Rivers. The man faces one count of hit and run involving death, homicide by negligent operation of a vehicle, and three counts of recklessly endangering safety in connection with the passengers in Newman's vehicle. And this was an incident that the passenger told police that they were traveling close to 100 miles per hour. Another witness told police that he was driving north of Memorial Drive at about 45 to 50 miles per hour when he saw a red pickup truck driving north being chased by a blue Chevy pickup truck. He estimated they were traveling at between 85 and 90 miles per hour. The witness said he saw the two make contact, watched the truck crash into the guardrail, and the blue truck speed off. Lischka allegedly sideswiped Newman, causing him to lose control. Preliminary tests indicated that alcohol and drugs were factors in the crash. And so this is, according to the police chief, one of the occupants of Eric's vehicle had a disagreement with a person from Manitowoc, and they drove to the 100 block of Revere Drive to find the person. Sean was there and told them the person they were looking for was not there. They then jumped into the vehicle and took off, and that's when Sean got into the vehicle and started chasing them. So it appears to be, if the complaints are true, an incident where road rage was involved. In addition, they're alleging that there was there were other things involved as well that we've gone over. But this is something that is becoming more and more common, I think, in terms of road rage incidents. People get very, very aggressive and can get very, very aggressive behind the wheel. And we've seen a number of these pop up in our community and surrounding communities because people just tend to sometimes lose control once they're behind the wheel because they get into some type of disagreement with other people. But another story this week is the second John Doe probe that's targeting allegedly members of that may implicate Governor Walker's administration. There's a lot of speculation mounting about this. But the secret investigation is apparently looking into whether certain groups such as the Club for Growth, Americans for Prosperity, Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce, and other committees were coordinating their political activities with partisan campaigns during the 2012 recall election. That is a big no-no in terms of coordinating that. The groups, which collectively spent tens of millions of dollars in ads praising Walker, Governor Walker, or blasting his opponents in the run-up election held in June of 2012, are strictly prohibited from coordinating their messaging or any other aspect of their political strategy with candidates for public office. This according to the Wisconsin State Journal. But whether or not the investigation turns up the necessary evidence to prosecute the groups, the notion that their leaders may have been working hand-in-hand with the governor's campaign does not come as a surprise to those familiar with how third-party groups operate. And Jay Heck, the executive director of Common Cause Wisconsin, essentially says that he's not surprised that this is going on because he speculates that this goes on actually fairly frequently. And so there have been subpoenas that have been issued, but as we've talked about in the past, a John Doe proceeding is a secret proceeding. And so the witnesses, in many cases, are prohibited from speaking about it, even if they want to, in their own defense. So there has been criticism about this, but one of the leaders that's looking into this is Francis Schmitz, who apparently was up for the United States attorney job in terms of being appointed by President George W. Bush. And so there are others going around. There are news stories going around about judges being involved in this. Of course, Francis Schmitz is a bit hard to attack, at least as a liberal partisan, because he really, frankly, doesn't seem to be. In fact, he seems to be a Republican, at least according to news accounts. But there are other judges that are peripherally involved in the John Doe proceedings, but we don't know exactly what their involvement is because, as you know, much of this is held in secret. But some of the conservative groups are attacking the judges that are involved in this. And, you know, so this is coming to be a very big political story, and it's really not meant to be or shouldn't be a political story. And it shouldn't be motivated by politics, but the Milwaukee County DA's office has come under fire for the last John Doe investigation. Of course, the last John Doe investigation did not implicate Governor Walker or charge him with any kind of crime. However, several of his aides or associates were convicted of crimes. and some of them serving sentences. So it's something that's become very, very a political football for lots of people. The governor coming out saying he thinks it's politically motivated, others saying it's not politically motivated. There's speculation about the governor running for president. And so there's a whole lot of politics involved with this whole thing. But why does this actually matter to Wisconsin? And I think the real reason it matters to Wisconsin is we want to make sure, or Wisconsinites want to have this belief, at least, that what's going on in Wisconsin politics, there is no coordinating from outside groups that are not legally authorized to do so. That we have these grassroots campaigns. And if you ever notice, those are the terms that both Democrats and Republicans use. They talk about grassroots campaigns a lot because I think they want to at least give the impression that there's not a lot of big money coming in from outside groups. The reason for that is if they can characterize it as a grassroots campaign, then it seems more genuine, it seems more legitimate, and it seems more real in terms of what their candidates are standing for. But this event and this story will probably only get hotter as we go on and move into the heat of election season. And of course, we'll follow that here on Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey. I'm Casey Hoff. Remember, you can join us every Saturday morning right here on 1330 WHBL from 8 to 9. This has been another edition of Legal Defense. Have a wonderful weekend, and we'll see you next week.